5. Screws. Screws and bolts live in those mysteriously thin cabinets in the back aisle of the hardware store, along with their friends, bolts, nuts, and washers. Tighten a nut on a bolt to keep things ultra-secure. A washer, that's a flat circular object that slips on the bolt between the nut and the surface, protects the surface, and helps tighten the nut. Remembering the saying, righty-tighty, lefty-loosey, will help you recall which direction to turn a screw. 6. Wrench. Wrenches tighten and untighten the nuts that go at the end of the bolts. They come in the open-end fixed-size variety and the adjustable. A small set of open-end wrenches, or one adjustable wrench, should start you off well. 7. Pliers. For gripping objects, like a stuck faucet, get a versatile groove joint pliers. Also handy is a needle nose pliers to grab small objects, like wire. It often has a little wire cutter built in. Peek at the intersection of the handles, and you'll find it. 8. Glue gun. When you can't use screws, bolts, or nails, a glue gun saves the day and is quite fun to operate. A small one should do, and don't forget plenty of glue sticks to melt in it. 9. Tape measure. A 16-foot retractable tape measure that can lock in place is a good start. 10. Saw. A saw is not for the very young, of course, but it's a necessity for cutting wood to size and making shapes. A hand saw is a flat hand tool. A modern jigsaw is a power tool activated by a trigger. All power tools are extremely dangerous if they are not used exactly as specified in their instructions, and you should always have adult supervision when operating them. Hold long strips of wood on a sawhorse, a beam connected by four legs. Cut small pieces of wood off the edge of a work table. Be careful, ask for help, and as always, use your safety glasses. 11. Drill. To drill, start with an awl or center punch, hand tools that look like small spikes, to make an indentation in your surface so that the drill bit won't slip. Bits are the small cutting pieces you fit into your drill for each project. A battery-operated power drill is very handy. It will come with a basic set of bits, or you can get a set if it doesn't. There's an art to matching up the right drill bit to the size of the hole you'll need for the screw. If you know the size of the bolt or screw, that helps. Otherwise, the best we can tell you is to peer closely at the sizes, and when in doubt, try the smaller bit first. Experience will make all the more clear. Once you have your own toolbox, you might begin to truly love the hardware store. You'll stand for hours looking at the display of unique drill bits to make holes in metal, brick, plastic, or stone, at the sander attachment that can remove paint or brush wood's rough edges clean, at the buffer that smooths it to perfection. You'll handle each one carefully, and after much deliberation with the burly hardware store guy about the pros and cons of each, take some home to try out on a project of your own imagination. The Daring Girl's Guide to Danger. Facing your fears can be a rewarding experience, and pushing yourself to new heights will inspire you to face challenges throughout life. Here, in no particular order, is a checklist of danger and daring. Some you should be able to do right away, but a few you might need to work up to. 1. Ride a roller coaster. The biggest roller coaster drops in America include the Kingdom Ka at Six Flags Great Adventure in New Jersey at 418 feet, the Top Thrill Dragster in Ohio at 400 feet, and Superman The Escape in California at 328 feet. But the scariest coaster ride in America is still the Cyclone in Coney Island. Built in the 1920s, this comparatively small metal and wooden ride packs an unbelievable punch with sudden drops and hairpin turns. 2. Ride a zip line across the canopy of a rainforest. A trip to Costa Rica offers incredible adventures, including flying across the roof of the world 200 feet off the ground, with distances between trees of up to 1,200 feet. Many outdoor centers around the country also offer zip line courses. 3. Go whitewater rafting. Most people think looking at the Grand Canyon from the rim down is scary, but a true act of daring is to take a whitewater rafting trip down the stretch of Colorado River that cuts through it. Some trips even include a helicopter ride for an extra dose of danger. 4. Have a scary movie festival in your living room. Some good ones are The Exorcist, Jaws, Alien, The Shining, and Alfred Hitchcock's classic but still frightening Psycho. But don't blame us if you can't go to sleep without wondering what's under the bed. 5. Wear high heels. This may not sound so dangerous, but without practice, you can fall or twist an ankle. For your first time in heels, borrow someone else's and make sure to start on a hard surface like wood. Once you're feeling steady on your feet, give carpeting a try. If you can wear heels on a thick carpet, you can do anything. Eventually, if it's a skill you want to learn, you'll be able to run, jump, and do karate in 3-inch heels. 6. Stand up for yourself or someone else. It's scary to feel like you're the only one who doesn't agree, but when something's wrong, a daring girl speaks up for herself or someone who needs an ally. Summon your courage and raise your voice. Real bravery is feeling the fear and doing it anyway. 7. Try sushi or another exotic food. California rolls do not count. For the true daring girl, try some natto, fermented soybeans, or escargot, snails. 8. Dye your hair purple. Sometimes the scariest thing is just being a little bit different, even for a day. There are many hair dyes that wash out after a few weeks, so you can experience what it would be like to have a lime green ponytail without having to wait for all your hair to grow out to change it again. Joan of Arc. One life is all we have, and we live it as we believe in living it. But to sacrifice what you are and to live without belief, that is a fate more terrible than dying. Joan of Arc. Joan was born around 1412 in the small town of Domremy in France, on the border of the provinces of Champagne and Lorraine, to Jacques d'Arc and Isabelle Romy. She grew up helping her father and brothers work the land and helping her mother, a devout woman, tend the house. The year she turned 12, she became convinced that there was something special about her, a destiny she alone could fulfill. She began hearing the voices of St. Michael, St. Catherine, and St. Margaret, whom she believed had been sent by God to inform her of her divine mission to save France. So compelled was she by the urgency of these voices that by the time she was 15, she cut her hair, began dressing in a man's uniform, and took up arms. France and England were deep into the Hundred Years' War at this point. At that time in history, the two nations were not as separate as they are now, and there was a battle raging over who should be king of the general area. By 1429, Henry VI of England was claiming the throne, and the English occupied Paris and all of northern France. Joan had two missions, thanks to the voices that guided her: to recover her homeland from English domination and reclaim the besieged city of Orleans, and to see the Dauphin of France, Charles VII, crowned king. She left her home without telling her parents and appealed to the captain of the Dauphin's army, telling him of her divine mission. He initially dismissed the notion of a 15-year-old girl having the leadership capacity to head his forces. However, her persistence and clarity of vision ultimately convinced him, and she went on to convince the Dauphin as well that she was on a mission from God, meant to save him and restore France. After being examined by a board of theologians, she was given the rank of captain and allowed to lead men into battle. She was 17 when she led her troops to victory over the English at the Battle of Orleans in May 1429. She rode in white armor and carried a banner bearing the likenesses of her three saints. She organized her army of men into professional soldiers, and even required them to attend Mass and go to confession. So formidable was her leadership that it was said when her troops approached, the enemy fled the battlefield. But by far her most innovative act was instilling among her people a sense of nationalism and patriotic pride. She was one of the first leaders to consider England and France as separate countries, with separate cultures and traditions that were worth fighting to preserve. Due in great part to Joan's leadership on the battlefield, Charles VII was crowned King of France on July 17, 1429, in Reims Cathedral. Her victory, however, was short-lived. She was captured by the Burgundians in 1430 while defending Compiègne near Paris and was sold to the English. The English turned her over to the court at Rouen to be tried for witchcraft and crimes against the church. Though the witchcraft charge was dismissed, on the grounds that she was a virgin, she was accused of perpetrating crimes against God by wearing men's clothing. After a 14-month trial, during which she never strayed from her insistence on the divinity of her voices and the absolute rightness of her calling, Joan was convicted and burned at the stake in the Rouen marketplace on May 30, 1431. Her last words were, "Jesus, Jesus." She was 19 years old. Almost 25 years after her death, Pope Calixtus III reopened the case at the request of Inquisitor General Jean Brial and Joan's mother, Isabelle Romée. Joan was vindicated as a martyr and declared an innocent woman on July 7, 1456. It was nearly 500 years after her death that she was canonized as a saint on May 16, 1920, by Pope Benedict XV. Joan of Arc is now recognized as the patron saint of France. The story of a girl guided by voices to change the world has proved irresistible to storytellers and artists from the time of her death to the present day. She continues to serve as an inspiration to daring girls everywhere. Queens of the Ancient World. Salome Alexandra of Judea. Salome's story is a tale of diplomacy, of managing the constant challenges of royal leadership, and of resisting attacks from outside armies, as well as from members of her own family. She is remembered as the last independent ruler of her country, Judea, during the period just before the countries of the Mediterranean were conquered by Rome. Salome Alexandra was born in 140 BC. Not much is known of her girlhood. Her Judean name was Shelem Zion, which is translated as Salome. Her Greek name was Alexandra, after Alexander the Great, who brought his Greek armies to the region nearly 200 years earlier. Like many people of her time, Salome lived amid her family and clan and spoke their language, Aramaic. She was also versed in the Hellenistic culture and Greek language that united the many lands around the Mediterranean Sea, including the nearby empires of Egypt and Syria. From what historians can piece together, it seems Salome Alexandra first married in her late 20s. Her choice of husband, Aristobulus, the eldest son of the native ruler of Judea, led her both to royal life and to the beginning of her family problems. Aristobulus was intensely ambitious. When his father, the king, died in 104 BC, he willed the country to Aristobulus's mother. But his eldest son would have none of it. He imprisoned his mother, starved her to death, and jailed three of his brothers. In this brutal way, Judea became his, and Salome became the reigning queen. Just a year later, though, Aristobulus died of a mysterious disease. As Salome performed the proper funeral rites over him, she learned that he had bequeathed the kingdom to her. Salome was faced with another complicated decision. Should she rule by herself or share the throne? She released the three royal brothers from jail and chose the eldest of them to be king and high priest. His name was Alexander Janaeus. She married him and continued her life as queen. Her second husband, Alexander, was a tough man to live with. He was mean-tempered and he drank too much. He was fond of raiding and pillaging nearby cities, and he was cruel to his own people. He reigned for 27 years. The historian Josephus tells us that as much as the people hated Alexander, they adored Salome and considered her wise, kind, strong and reliable, decent, fair, and a person of good judgment. It's possible that during Alexander's long rule, the people didn't rise to overthrow him because they loved Salome so much. In 76 BC, Alexander was on his deathbed. He called Salome close and bequeathed the kingdom to her, returning the favor she had granted him 27 years before. Alexander presented Salome with a plan. "Conceal my death until under your command the soldiers will have won this battle we are now fighting. March back to the capital, Jerusalem, and hold a victory. I have oppressed many people, and they now hate me. Make peace with them. Tell them you will include their leaders as advisors in your government. Finally, when you return to Jerusalem, send for the leading men. Show them my dead body and give it over to them. Let them defile it if they wish, or honor me with a proper burial. The choice will be theirs, and then they will support you." Quite a beginning for the new reigning queen. As queen, ruling from her place in Jerusalem, Salome faced immediate challenges from her family once more, this time from her two grown sons. Salome anointed her oldest son, Hyrcanus, a quieter and more private sort of man, to be high priest. Hebrew religious law forbade women from overseeing the temple and performing the animal sacrifices, so although she was queen, she couldn't be high priest as her husband had been. Her younger son, named Aristobulus after Salome's first ruthless husband, was a much bigger problem. Like his father, he was very ambitious. He wanted Salome's throne from the start. Soon, he would rise against her. True to her promises and King Alexander's plan, Salome delegated the domestic affairs and a good deal of the power over the nation's religious life to the elders of Judea. This helped to end the civil war that had simmered under her husband's rule, during which he had killed a great many of the elders' group. Still, the remaining elders wanted revenge. Before Salome could stop them, they slit the throat of one of Alexander's ringleaders, Diogenes, and set out to find more. The ambitious son of Aristobulus used the growing violence to threaten his mother's reign. After the revenge killings, Aristobulus led a delegation of men to Salome's throne. They demanded she put a stop to the killings. If she could do so, they promised they would not avenge the recent murders. They would keep the country from descending into a spiral of violence. In return for keeping the peace, Aristobulus demanded his mother give him several of the family fortresses strung throughout the desert, from Jerusalem to the Jordan River. Salome negotiated a deal. She kept the majority of the fortresses for herself, including those that housed her royal treasure, but she gave a few to Aristobulus. Seeking to push him far from her capital, she dispatched him on a small military mission to Damascus. As Salome dealt with the situation at home, another problem was brewing outside of Judea. The country's northern neighbor, Syria, was very weak. The Seleucid dynasty that had once controlled the entire region was in its last days. Taking advantage of this weakness, King Tigranes of Armenia descended on Syria with a massive army of 500,000 soldiers, quickly taking over Syria's cities. Tigranes trapped the Syrian queen, Cleopatra Selene, in the city of Ptolemais on the Mediterranean coast. Ptolemais was not far from Salome's city of Jerusalem. Terrible news of the siege reached Salome quickly, as did the rumor that Tigranes planned to march on Judea next. Salome knew that despite her large army of mercenaries and native soldiers, she could not beat Tigranes. Rather than ready her troops for war, Queen Salome took a different stance. She sent her ambassadors to meet with King Tigranes, and sent along with them many camels loaded with extraordinary treasure. Tigranes agreed not to attack. Luck was on Salome's side because another army had begun to attack Armenia. Instead of marching south toward Jerusalem, Tigranes had turned north to defend his own people back home. That episode, and the years of strife leading up to it, wore Salome down. She was over 70, and her health was beginning to fail. She had outlived two husbands, she faced attacks from outsiders, and her youngest son continued to undermine her authority from within. Sensing her final frailty, Aristobulus planned a coup. He had been angry that Salome negotiated a peace with King Tigranes. Had it been up to him, he would have led their soldiers to battle. He knew she was near death, and he suspected that she would bequeath the throne to his older brother, who was already the high priest. Secretly, Aristobulus left the family palace in Jerusalem. He rode his horse through the countryside, and at each city and village he asked the people to forswear their allegiance to Queen Salome and pledge their loyalty to him. Salome gathered her last ounce of strength and decided to take harsh action against her son. She imprisoned his wife and children, much as her first husband had done to his relatives. She stashed them in a fortress next to the temple where Hyrcanus was high priest, but she knew her time was running out. She gave Hyrcanus the keys to the treasury and directed him to take command of her army. Salome Alexandra died soon thereafter, in 67 BC, before Aristobulus could strike against her. She was 73, had reigned for 9 years as her people's only independent queen, and she died a natural death. Salome took part in no great battles. She commanded no stunning ships on the sea. She merely did her best to keep the peace at home and to keep stronger armies at bay. Queen Salome was so admired that for many generations, hers was one of the two most popular names that Judean people would give to their baby daughters, including one infamous Salome who appears in the New Testament. She couldn't have known that she would be the only Judean queen, and that this era of independent states was about to end. In the year Salome died, across the sea in Italy an empire was growing. The Roman general Pompey was fighting the pirates who controlled the Mediterranean. He cleared them out and made it safe once again to cross the vast waters by boat. By 64 BC, Pompey forged his soldiers into battalions and started his eastward trek. He took control of Syria later that year and of Judea the year after. Soon all of Western Asia was under Rome's hand, and the era of Queen Salome the diplomat was a distant memory. Slumber Party Games. There is usually not much slumber involved in your typical slumber party. Instead, pajama-clad girls stay up into the wee hours talking, watching movies, playing games, telling stories, having pillow fights, and giggling. It's a chance for girls to enjoy the bonding element of playing together as a group and revel in subverting the normal evening routine, sleeping in the living room together instead of in bed alone, staying up well past bedtime, being awake in the dark, telling scary stories. It's a time for mystery and daring, as illustrated by some of the most popular slumber party games played by girls over the years. Bloody Mary. Who was Bloody Mary? There are many different stories of who the real Bloody Mary was. The Bloody Mary of slumber party fame has been linked to Queen Mary Tudor of England, who gained the nickname of Bloody Mary when she had more than 300 people burned at the stake during her reign because they would not follow her Roman Catholic faith. She is also sometimes confused with Mary Queen of Scots, Bloody Mary Tudor's cousin, who in fact may have been instead the subject of a much more benign children's tradition, the nursery rhyme, Mary, Mary, Quite Contrary. In other versions, Bloody Mary is also thought to be the ghost of Mary Worth, a supposed witch killed in the Salem witch trials, though no historical record of a person by that name exists. The most far-fetched version of the story is rooted in the legend of a woman named Elizabeth Bathory, a 16th-century countess who was rumored to have killed girls and then bathed them in their blood to retain her youth. Her name wasn't Mary, obviously, but the nickname she earned, the Blood Countess, may contribute to her confusion with the Bloody Mary of countless slumber parties. The most mundane story associated with the Bloody Mary myth is that Mary was a local woman who was killed in a car accident. Her ghostly visage features a horrible facial disfiguration she received in the crash. No matter which story you decide to go with, and there are merits to each of them, the basic method of summoning the restless spirit of Bloody Mary is the same: a darkened room, a mirror, and the chanting of her name. Why the mirror? Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the fairest one of all? Is probably the most familiar rhyme about the magical divination possibilities of your own reflection. Indeed, girls in ancient times were encouraged to eat a red apple and brush their hair at midnight in front of a mirror, whereupon they would be rewarded with a glimpse of their future husbands. The red apple and the mirror both figure prominently in the Snow White story we know today. Other rituals involving a mirror required spinning around a certain number of times or looking over your shoulder, the end result being, again, the revelation of whom you might marry. Even today, we have less binding versions of these chanting rituals and superstitions. Think, he loves me, he loves me not, to see if someone likes you, or the twisting of an apple stem while chanting the alphabet to discover the first initial of the person you like best. What does this have to do with Bloody Mary? One of the variations of the Bloody Mary chant was, Bloody Mirror, Bloody Mirror. This combined with the idea that you were supposed to discover who you were going to marry by looking in the mirror, plus the gruesome legends of various Marys who were bloody themselves, easily evolved into the Bloody Mary game we know today. How to play. Go into the bathroom or another darkened room with a mirror, holding a flashlight beneath your chin so that it lights up your face in a ghostly way. Close the door and turn off all the lights. Stand in front of the mirror and chant Bloody Mary 13 times to summon the spirit of Bloody Mary. Ideally, this should be done alone, but you can take your friends in there with you for moral support, which you may indeed require, since the legend is that if you get to the 13th chant of her name, Bloody Mary will appear in the mirror and either reach out to scratch your face, pull you into the mirror with her, or scare you to death. However, some people believe Bloody Mary isn't always cruel. They say if you're lucky, you'll just see her face in the mirror, or she'll appear and answer your questions about the future. And even if no face appears in the mirror, there are other ways Bloody Mary can make her presence felt. A scar or cut that wasn't there before, a window slamming shut, or other eerie happenings. Ultra-daring girls can play this game with one crucial variation: turning off the flashlight and summoning Bloody Mary completely in the dark. Truth or Dare? How to play. Truth or Dare, the essential sleepover party game, goes by several different names. Sometimes it is called Truth Dare Double Dare, and there is also a variation called Truth Dare Double Dare Promise to Repeat. In its most basic version, Truth or Dare, players take turns choosing between a truth or a dare and must either answer a question or perform a dare determined by the other players. The questions can be as embarrassing as you like, and the dares as risky as you can imagine, but neither should ever be harmful. First, because the game is supposed to be fun, and second, because what you ask or dare may come back to haunt you when it's your turn to choose. In Truth, Dare, or Double Dare, the players have a choice between telling the truth when asked a question, performing a minor dare, and performing a bigger dare. In Truth, Dare, Double Dare, Promise to Repeat, there is the added choice of promising to repeat something, usually embarrassing, in public later. It's a good idea to set some ground rules before you play so that nobody gets her feelings hurt or gets into too much trouble. Nothing that would get a girl in hot water with her parents. Nothing that requires going outside or bothering people not involved in the game. The other basic rule is that once you agree to tell the truth, perform a dare or double dare, or repeat something embarrassing in public later, there is no chickening out. If you refuse to do what's asked of you, you're out of the game. Examples. Truth. You have to answer a personal question. This can be something like, What's your deepest, darkest secret? What was your most embarrassing moment? When was the last time you brushed your teeth? What superpower do you wish you had? Dare. You have to do an easy dare, such as act like a chicken for 30 seconds, wear your underwear on your head the rest of the night, do 10 push-ups, or act out a dramatic death scene. Double dare. A bigger, more embarrassing dare, such as kiss a stuffed animal with sound effects. Try to pick your nose with your big toe and then wipe it on somebody. Sing the national anthem at the top of your lungs. Must be done. Promise to repeat. If you don't want to tell the truth or perform a potentially humiliating dare, you can choose promise to repeat, which requires you to promise to repeat something embarrassing in public later, like agreeing to include the word stultifying in every sentence you say to your mom the next day. Light as a feather, stiff as a board. How to play. Have one person lay on the ground while 4 to 6 others gather around her. The player should place the index fingers of both hands underneath the person lying down. And then, with eyes closed, everyone begins to chant, light as a feather, stiff as a board. After 20 chants or so, or whatever number of chants you agree upon ahead of time, the players start raising their arms, lifting the person, and seemingly levitating her above the ground. One variation is to play this game as a call-and-response story. The player next to the person's head begins the story with, "It was a dark and stormy night." Each player, except the one lying on the ground, repeats the phrase one at a time, and then the player at the head continues, "It was cold and the road was icy." Everyone repeats, then the head player says, "The car she was in spun out of control." Everyone repeats. Then, "And when they found her," everyone repeats. Then, "She was light as a feather." Everyone repeats, then, "and stiff as a board." These last two sentences are repeated by the group several times, and then the entire group begins chanting, "light as a feather, stiff as a board," and lifting up the person who is lying down. Is your slumber party guest really levitating? The light as a feather, stiff as a board slumber party game has its roots in a long tradition of unexplainable, seemingly miraculous feats of weightlessness. Levitation, from the Latin word levis, or light, means to float in the air, and numerous religions from Christianity to Islam have stories of levitation by shamans, mediums, saints, and those demonically possessed. Saints who levitated were said to possess a luminous glow. Among the reported levitators was Saint Teresa of Avila, who levitated while in states of rapture in the 1680s and is usually painted with a bird, signifying her ability to fly. Saint Edmund around 1242. Saint Joseph of Cupertino, who astonished the church with his flights in the 1600s. Catherine of Siena in the late 14th century. And Saint Adolphus Liguori in 1777. Reports of levitation in more recent times include Father Suarez in 1911 in southern Argentina, and also at the beginning of the 20th century, the Passionist nun Gemma Galgani. The Christian saints, priests, and nuns generally attributed their levitation to states of rapture or ecstasy that were beyond their control, while in Hinduism, Buddhism, and other Eastern traditions, levitation was presented as a skill that could be accomplished through spiritual and physical training. Levitation, like all things otherworldly, turned demonic in the Middle Ages, where rather than being a signal of a person's divinity and proximity to God, it was seen as a manifestation of evil generated by demons, ghosts, or witchcraft. The 19th century spiritualism movement in America, with its interest in seances, ghosts, poltergeists, and other spooky things, help give levitation a boost once again. But in modern times, it's mostly understood to be a magic trick, a phenomenon based in real-world explanations and techniques. Still, as anyone who has seen David Blaine or played light as a feather, stiff as a board at slumber parties can attest, it's entertaining, even when you're pretty sure it's not real. Pirates. There have been women pirates throughout the ages, from Queen Artemisia to female Vikings to modern-day women pirates in the Philippines. Many of the stories about female pirates are just that, stories made up showcasing women pirates who are merely fictional. But there are several women pirates whose stories are verifiable and who really did live, and in some cases, die a pirate's life on the high seas. Charlotte Badger. Charlotte Badger was a convicted felon when she was sent to Australia from England. She was found guilty of the crime of breaking and entering when she was 18 years old and sentenced to 7 years deportation. She sailed to Port Jackson, Sydney, aboard the convict ship the Earl of Cornwallis in 1801 and served 5 years of her sentence at a factory, during which time she also gave birth to a daughter. With just 2 years of her sentence left, she was assigned to work as a servant to a settler in Hobart Town, Tasmania, along with fellow prisoner Catherine Haggerty. In April 1806, Charlotte, her daughter, Catherine, and several male convicts traveled to Hobart Town on a ship called Venus. When the Venus docked at Port Dalrymple in June, the convicts mutinied, and Charlotte and her friend Catherine joined in with the male convicts to seize control of the ship. The pirate crew headed for New Zealand, even though nobody aboard really knew how to navigate the ship, and Charlotte, her child, Catherine, and two of the male convicts were dropped off at Rangihau Bay in the Bay of Islands. Charlotte and her compatriots built huts and lived on the shore of the island, but by 1807, Catherine Haggerty was dead, and the two men had fled. The Venus had long since been overtaken by South Sea Islanders, who captured the crew and then burned the ship. Charlotte and her child stayed on Rangihau Bay, living alongside the Maori Islanders. Twice she was offered passage back to Port Jackson, and twice she refused, saying that she preferred to die among the Maori. What happened to Charlotte after 1807 isn't entirely clear. Some stories have her living with a Maori chieftain and bearing another child. In other stories, the Maori turned on her, prompting her and her daughter to flee to Tonga. Still other stories eventually place her in America, having stowed away on another ship. Whatever happened to her, she was quite possibly the first European woman to have lived in New Zealand and one of New Zealand's first women pirates. Anne Bonny and Mary Read. Anne Bonny, born in Ireland around 1700, is by all accounts one of the best-known female pirates. She was disowned by her father when, as a young teen, she married a sailor named James Bonny. The newlyweds then left Ireland for the Bahamas. There, James worked as an informant, turning in pirates to the authorities for a tidy sum. While James confronted pirates, Anne befriended them. She became especially close with Jack Rackham, also known as Calico Jack. Jack was a pirate who had sworn off pirating so as to receive amnesty from the Bahamian governor, who had promised not to prosecute any pirate who gave up his pirating ways. In 1719, however, Anne and Jack ran off together, and Jack promptly returned to pirating, this time with Anne by his side. She donned men's clothing in order to join the crew on his ship, the Revenge, and was so good at the work that she was accepted as a crewmate, even by those men who discovered she was actually a woman. When the Revenge took another ship during a raid and absorbed its crew, Anne discovered she was no longer the only woman on board. A woman by the name of Mary Read had also disguised herself as a man to be accepted as a pirate. Mary, born in London in the late 1600s, had spent nearly her whole life disguised as a man. Mary's mother had raised her as a boy almost from birth to keep the family out of poverty. Mary's father died before she was born, and her brother, who would have been the only legal heir, also died. Back then, only men could inherit wealth, so baby Mary became baby Mark. As a young girl living as a boy, Mary worked as a messenger and eventually enlisted in the infantry, fighting in Flanders and serving with distinction. She fell in love with another soldier, to whom she revealed her true gender, and they soon married, leaving the army to run a tavern called the Three Horseshoes. Sadly, her husband died in 1717, and Mary once again had to disguise herself as a man to earn a living. She put on her dead husband's clothes, enlisted in the army, and went to Holland. She found no adventure there, so she boarded a ship for the West Indies. That was when her ship was captured by the Revenge, and her life intersected with those of Calico Jack and his mistress, Anne Bonny. Anne and Mary became close friends, and once Anne knew the truth about Mary, she swore that she would never reveal Mary's true identity. But Calico Jack, jealous of Anne's attention, grew suspicious of their friendship and demanded an explanation. Soon the secret was out, but luckily for Mary, Jack was relieved and not angered to discover she was a woman. He allowed her to continue on the crew, and just as Anne had been accepted by her crewmates despite being female, Mary was accepted too. Unfortunately for the crew of the Revenge, the Bahamian governor was not so accepting of pirates who flouted amnesty agreements by returning to pirating after promising not to, and he issued a proclamation naming Jack Rackham, Anne Bonny, and Mary Read as pirates and enemies to the crown of Great Britain. In 1720, the Revenge was attacked by a pirate hunter eager to capture an enemy of the crown. Calico Jack, along with nearly the entire crew, was drunk at the time, and the men quickly retreated to hide below deck and wait out the attack. Only Anne and Mary stayed above, fighting for the ship. It is said that Anne shouted to the crew, "If there's a man among ye, you'll come out and fight like the men ye are thought to be." Enraged by the crew's cowardice, Anne and Mary shot at them, killing one man and wounding several others, including Calico Jack. Despite the women's efforts, the ship was captured. The crew was taken to Jamaica and tried for piracy in November of 1720. All of them were hanged, save for Anne and Mary, who were granted stays of execution due to the fact that they were both pregnant. Mary was brave in the face of her punishment, telling the court, "As to hanging, it is no great hardship. For were it not for that, every cowardly fellow would turn pirate and so unfit the sea that men of courage must starve." But as it turned out, Mary never had to face the gallows. She died in prison of a fever. As for Anne, after the piracy trial, the historical record is silent. Rumors say alternately that she was hanged a year later, that she was given a reprieve, that she reconciled with her father who disowned her, or with her first husband whom she had left, that she gave up the pirate's life and became instead a nun. We may never know for sure what happened to her. Ching Shir. Ching Shir, also known as Shi Shangu, Cheng Yisao, Ching Yisao, or Zheng Yisao, ruled the South China Sea in the early 19th century, overseeing about 1,800 ships and 80,000 male and female pirates. She became the commander of the infamous Red Flag Fleet of Pirates after her husband, Cheng Yi, the former commander from a long line of pirates, died in 1807. She went on to marry Cheng Pao, formerly her husband's right-hand man. To say that Ching Shir ran a tight ship was an understatement. Pirates who committed even innocuous offenses were beheaded. Her attitude in battle was even more intense, with hundreds of ships and thousands of pirates used to engage even a small target. Ching Shir was also a ruthless businesswoman. She handled all business matters herself, and pirates not only needed her approval to embark on a raid, they were also required to surrender the entire haul to her. She diversified her business plan by expanding beyond the raiding of commercial ships, working with shadowy businessmen in the Guangdong salt trade. Every ship passing through her waters had to buy protection from her, and Ching Shir's fleet of mercenaries torched any vessel that refused to pay up. The Red Flag Fleet under Ching Shir's rule could not be defeated, not by Chinese officials, not by the Portuguese Navy, not by the British. But in 1810, amnesty was offered to all pirates, and Ching Shir took advantage of it, negotiating pardons for nearly all her troops. She retired with all her ill-gotten gains and ran a gambling house until her death in 1844. Rachel Wall. Rachel Schmidt was born in Carlisle, Pennsylvania in 1760. When she was 16, she met George Wall, a former privateer who served in the Revolutionary War. Against the wishes of her mother, she married him. The two moved to Boston, where George worked as a fisherman and Rachel worked as a maid in Beacon Hill. George, whom Rachel's mother had considered more than slightly shady to begin with, fell in with a rough crowd and gambled away what money they had. Unable to pay the rent, and lured by the fun of his fast-living fisherman friends, he hit upon pirating as the answer to their financial woes and convinced Rachel to join in. George and Rachel stole a ship at Essex and began working as pirates off the Isle of Shoals. They would trick the passing ships by having the blue-eyed, brown-haired Rachel pose as a damsel in distress, standing at the ship's mast and screaming for help as passing ships floated by. Once the rescuing crew came aboard to help, George and his men would kill them, steal their booty, and sink their ship. Rachel and George were successful as pirates, capturing a dozen boats, murdering 24 sailors, and stealing thousands of dollars in cash and valuables. Their evil plan was cut short in 1782 when George, along with the rest of his crew, was drowned in a storm. Rachel, who really did need rescuing in that situation, was saved, brought ashore, and taken back to Boston, but it was hard to leave her pirating ways. She spent her days working as a maid, but by night she broke into the cabins of ships docked in Boston Harbor, stealing any goods she could get her hands on. Her luck ran out in 1789 when she was accused of robbery. At her trial, she admitted to being a pirate, but refused to confess to being a murderess or a thief. She was convicted and sentenced to death by hanging. She died on October 8, 1789, the first and possibly the only woman pirate in all of New England, and the last woman to be hanged in Massachusetts. A Short History of Women Inventors and Scientists. Even though it's said that necessity is the mother of invention, women's contributions to inventing and science have been, in the past, often overlooked. It's likely women have been using their creativity and intelligence to engineer new ideas and products since the beginning of human experience, but nobody really kept track of such things until a few hundred years ago. Here, we've assembled some of our favorite daring women inventors, scientists, and doctors, from Nobel Prize winners to crafters of practical devices, from women who revolutionized the way diapers were changed to women whose revolutionary ideas changed the world. 1715. Sybilla Masters becomes the first American woman inventor in recorded history, though in accordance with the laws of the time, her patent for cleansing, curing, and refining of Indian corn growing in the plantations was issued in her husband Thomas's name by the British courts. Her husband was issued a second patent for another of her inventions, entitled Working and Weaving in a New Method, Palmetto Chip and Straw for Hats and Bonnets and Other Improvements of That Ware. 1809. Mary Dixon Keyes of Connecticut becomes the first U.S. woman to be issued a patent in her own name for her invention of a process for weaving straw with silk or thread. 1870. Martha Knight patents a machine to produce flat-bottomed paper bags. She also becomes the first woman in the United States to fight and win a patent suit when she defended her patent against a man who had stolen her design and filed for his own patent on it. He claimed a woman couldn't possibly have the mechanical knowledge needed to invent such a complex machine, but Knight was able to back up her claim. After her success, she went on to develop and patent several other machines, including rotary engines and automatic tools. 1875. Susan Taylor Converse of Woburn, Massachusetts, invents a one-piece, non-restrictive flannel undergarment. It was patented by manufacturers George Frost and George Phelps and marketed to American women, eager to free themselves from traditional tightly bound corsets, as the emancipation suit. 1876. Susan Hibbard patents the feather duster over protestations of her husband George Hibbard, who claimed the invention was his. The patent court justly awarded ownership of the patent to her. 1876. Emmeline Hart, a member of the Shaker community, invents and patents a commercial oven featuring pierced metal shelves for even heating, 4 separate oven compartments, isinglass mica windows, and a temperature gauge. 1885. Sarah E. Good, born a slave in 1850, obtains the first patent by an African-American woman inventor for her folding cabinet bed, a space saver that when folded up could be used as a desk, complete with compartments for stationery and writing supplies. 1888. Miriam Benjamin, a Washington, D.C. school teacher, becomes the second black woman to receive a patent. Her invention, the gong and signal chair for hotels, allowed hotel customers to summon a waiter from the comfort of their chairs and was adapted and used in the United States House of Representatives. 1889. Josephine Garris Cochran of Shelbyville, Illinois, invents the first working automatic dishwasher. Her invention was first shown at the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago, Illinois, and eventually went on to become associated with the KitchenAid Company. 1902. Ida Henrietta Hyde is named the first female member of the American Physiological Society. She was also the first woman to graduate from the University of Heidelberg and the first woman to do research at the Harvard Medical School. She went on to invent the microelectrode in the 1930s, which revolutionized the field of neurophysiology. 1903. Mary Anderson of Alabama invents the windshield wiper. Patented in 1905, windshield wipers became standard equipment on cars a decade later. 1903. Scientist Marie Curie is awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics for her discovery of the radioactive elements radium and polonium. She is awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1911, making her the first person to win 2 Nobel Prizes. 1912. Beulah Henry of Memphis, Tennessee, receives her first patent for an ice cream freezer. She went on to create over 100 inventions, including the first bobbinless sewing machine, an umbrella with changeable covers, and continuously attached envelopes for mass mailings. She earned a total of 49 patents, the last one issued in 1970. 1914. Mary Phelps Jacob invents the modern bra. She was inspired to fashion a comfortable upper body undergarment after becoming fed up with restrictive corsets. Her brassiere, made from 2 silk handkerchiefs and a ribbon, became so popular that after she patented the invention, she went on to sell it to the Warner Corset Company. 1930. Ruth Graves Wakefield, proprietor of the Toll House Inn in Whitman, Massachusetts, invents chocolate chips and chocolate chip cookies. Her cookie invention was called the Toll House Cookie and used broken-up bars of semi-sweet chocolate. 1932. Hattie Elizabeth Alexander, an American pediatrician and microbiologist, develops a serum to combat Haemophilus influenzae, which at that time had a fatality rate of 100% in infants. In 1964, she is the first woman to be elected president of the American Pediatric Society. 1935. Irene Joliot-Curie, the French scientist and daughter of Marie Curie, is awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry with her husband for their discovery of radioactivity, making the Curies the family with the most Nobel laureates to date. 1938. Catherine Blodgett, American physicist, invents a micro-thin barium stearate film to make glass completely non-reflective and invisible. Her invention has been used in eyeglasses, camera lenses, telescopes, microscopes, periscopes, and projector lenses. 1941. The actress Hedy Lamarr invents, along with George Antheil, a secret communication system to help combat the Nazis in World War II. 1950. Marion Donovan invents the disposable diaper. When established manufacturers show little interest in this invention, she starts her own company, Donovan Enterprises, which she sells along with her diaper patents to Keiko Corporation in 1951 for $1 million. 1951. Bessie Nesmith invents liquid paper, a quick-drying white liquid painted onto paper to correct mistakes. She was a secretary in Texas when she hit upon her invention, which became so successful it grew into the Liquid Paper Company. Fun fact, her son, Michael Nesmith, grew up to be a member of the 1960s rock group, The Monkees. 1952. Mathematician and U.S. Naval officer Rear Admiral Grace Murray Hopper invents the computer compiler, which revolutionized computer programming. She and her team also developed the first user-friendly business computer programming language, COBOL, Common Business-Oriented Language. 1953. Dr. Virginia Apgar, a professor of anesthesiology at the New York Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center, devises the Apgar scale, a test now used all over the world to determine the physical status of a newborn baby. 1956. Patsy Sherman invents Scotchgard. She was inducted into the Minnesota Inventors Hall of Fame in 1983. Patsy Sherman and her colleague Sam Smith jointly hold 13 patents in fluorochemical polymers and polymerization processes. 1957. Rachel Fuller Brown and Elizabeth Lee Hazen, researchers for the New York Department of Health, developed the antifungal antibiotic drug nystatin. The scientists donated the royalties from their invention, totaling over $13 million, to the nonprofit research corporation.